Before we kick off this episode, we are looking for your help. You can help nominate the Seahawkers podcast for the 15th annual People's Choice Podcast Awards by going to podcastawards.com. Click the text that says, click me to nominate my favorite podcasts, and select the Seahawkers podcast in the sports category. That's up at podcastawards.com. Please be sure and get your nominations in by 6 p.m. Pacific time on July 31st. That's up at podcastawards.com. This is the Seahawkers podcast. I'm Brandon Schultz, and we have some breaking news on Saturday. Just in the weeks leading up before the NFL season, there's been a lot of talk in this offseason about ways that the Seahawks could improve, and now it looks like they've gone out and done it just ahead of the 2020 season, making a big-time trade for Jets safety Jamal Adams. And joining me to talk about it is Rob Staton of SeahawksDraftBlog.com. Rob, this is, I've spent the last maybe 20, 30 minutes watching Jamal Adams highlights, and I'm fired up.
Yeah, Jamal Adams is a terrific player. He was at LSU, and the other thing that he really brought to LSU was his leadership and the tone setting that he provided on the field. He's like an alpha male, and it's something the Seahawks have perhaps lacked a little bit over the last few years. You know, since the reset, they've been trying to find guys who could come in and provide some intensity and an edge, and some of the guys that they brought in to do that haven't been able to deliver. He's a former top 10 pick, and the Seahawks don't usually get an opportunity to acquire players like that because they're often picking later in the first round. It would cost an awful lot to trade up. So they've acquired a really talented player at a good age. I think I'm right in saying he doesn't turn 25 until October. So, you know, you generally, I think LJ Collier was about that age when they drafted him. So, sure. You know, they're getting a player with, you know, you would hope if he can stay healthy, then you're looking at, you know, at least 6 years maybe of a career that you can feel pretty good about. And, you know, I have thought for a while this year, especially since coronavirus struck, that it might be a good thing to trade a 2021 first round pick, just because I don't know what kind of a college season we're going to have. Even if we have one, is it going to be the right kind of situation to be able to evaluate players and then make a sound decision on who could come in? You know, what kind of a position are some of these rookies going to be in to come into the league next year? Are they going to have a proper process with a proper combine and stuff like that? I mean, we just don't know where we're going to be next March, April time. If there was ever going to be a year to be very aggressive and make a trade, then this was probably it. So you go and get Jamal Adams, and it will improve the Seahawks defense. But I have to say, you know, those are the positive sides from it. I have a serious number of reservations about this trade as well.
Well, you know, it's important, I think, bringing up those qualifiers for the college season, too. It's something that I hadn't really thought about in terms of this compensation, because that's the first thing that jumps out at you is, Rob, holy smokes, what they're giving up to acquire Jamal Adams is something that we've, as Seahawks fans, I don't think we've ever seen this kind of compensation package to bring in a new player. The biggest trade that I can think of in terms of compensation was dealing Rick Meyer back in the 90s. But you know, just in the Pete Carroll, John Schneider era, you have Percy Harvin, which is the one who immediately comes to mind. And he was, you know, they were giving up an end of the first round pick. They gave up a seventh rounder and I think a third rounder the following year. And then they gave him a big contract. But in this case, you're giving up a veteran player like Bradley McDougal. You're giving up a first-round pick in 21, a first-round pick in 2022, a third-round pick in 2021, and you get back Adams and a fourth-round pick in 2022. So it's I guess if you include Bradley McDougal in there, maybe that's where that third and fourth come from, and then you're just saying Jamal Adams for two first-round picks. But you look at another big deal for Khalil Mack. And when the Raiders dealt him to the Bears, it was two first round picks.
Yeah, and this is why I've referred to it as it feels like a panic move on the blog, because let's just get one thing straight. Jamal Adams has been trying to leave the Jets for, you know, nearly a year. I mean, there was talk of him being traded before the trade deadline during the 2019 season. There was talk throughout the offseason of him potentially being traded. There's been talk for a number of weeks that he could be traded ahead of this season. If the Seahawks really believed they had to have Jamal Adams this offseason. Why didn't this trade happen the first week of the new league year, back in March? Why did they not just go and make this trade? Are we really saying that the Jets would have turned down this huge offer in March? Because I don't think they would. I think they'd have snapped their hands off for it. And if the then the Seahawks would have known one of the picks they were giving up, because it would have been a 2020 first-round pick in the, at the end of the first round. They would have been giving up their 2021 first-round pick as well. And again, we're talking about coronavirus and the impact there. And these were kind of topics that were being tentatively discussed during that draft as well, you know, when we talked about trading up. So
I think at that point, though, there was a lot more optimism toward having a season and even college football at that point. So there's a slight difference.
It's still, you know, the outlay suggests that the Seahawks, you know, for this, just the sheer amount that they have spent, that this is a player that they absolutely had to have.
Right.
And I'm a little bit confused why, if you feel that way about Jamal Adams, again, this isn't a new story in the last couple of weeks that he's demanded a trade and this has come out of the blue. He's been asking for a trade for a year.
I think even during the season, probably toward the end of last season, right?
Exactly. So why has it taken until days before training camp for this trade to be sorted? That's one question I would ask. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, and that would lend itself to, this is a panic move because they've had a bad off season and they feel like they've got to do something, and this is the best thing out there. There's no pass
rush. The one trade
available
that they made to improve their secondary, not looking, there could be a potential problem
You know, it seems to me like they felt like they had to do something, and this is the player that was available, and they've made the trade, and they've given up what it would have taken to give it up because they felt they had to do something, which would by definition be a panic move. You mentioned Khalil Mack and the outlay for him. I mean, just to remind people what that was. The Bears traded their 2019 first-round pick and their sixth-round pick and a 2020 first-round pick, so two firsts and a sixth. But in return, they received Oakland's second rounder in 2020 plus a conditional pick in the same class,
and there was a third round pick in there from the Bears to the Raiders too.
But it essentially it was, yes, to an extent, two first rounders, but it was essentially a first rounder and swapping a first for a second. So that was a cheaper trade than this one.
Well, I'd say the third and the second were kind of the swaps, because it was a 2020 second that they got back, and they gave up a 2023rd.
It feels like a cheaper deal.
Yeah.
A year ago, the Pittsburgh Steelers traded their 2020 first and sixth round picks, plus their sixth rounder in 2021 for Minkah Fitzpatrick, who plays, you know, he's a safety like Jamal Adams. He was a high pick like Jamal Adams. That is considerably cheaper than this trade. The LA Rams traded for Jalen Ramsey. It cost them a 2020 first round pick, a 2021 first rounder, and a fourth rounder next year as well. So, you know, Jalen Ramsey's a cornerback. Some people would argue that is a premium position. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the Laremy Tunsil trade, and, you know, everybody would say that left tackle is a premium position, especially with the dearth of good left tackles in the league. They give up two first rounders, a second round pick, and two fringe players, yet still receive Kenny Stills and a fourth rounder to go along with Laremy Tunsil. So, you know, some could argue that actually compared to this trade, that's, you know, a little bit cheaper than, I mean, it is a huge outlay for what is essentially a strong safety. And, you know, look, you can't pigeonhole him as a strong safety. He does so much more than just be a strong safety. I mean, he is not your traditional strong safety.
No, most strong safeties don't even rack up 100 tackles in a season generally. And, you know, he's a guy who is nearly averaged. He's at 273 tackles in three seasons. He's at 12 sacks over three seasons. So when you talk about those numbers of sacks, an average of four sacks per season, along with averaging nearly 100 tackles, that is a unique player.
He is a very unique player. He's a very good player. But it's generally unheard of for a safety of any form to go for that kind of level of compensation. And this is a precedent league, you know. Teams, when they are negotiating trades, compare to previous deals, and that's basically the foundation for talks to start, whether you're trading up in drafts or whether you're trading for veterans. And this just feels like, I don't really understand how it got to this point where it became this expensive. I mean, Tony Pauline was talking on a podcast. Tony Pauline's very well connected, especially with the New York Jets. I mean, mm-hmm. He has incredible sources of the Jets. He's a Jets season ticket holder, and he knows a lot of people within the Jets organization. And he was saying a few weeks ago that the Jets were willing to trade Jamal Adams straight up for Lyle Collins in Dallas. They were going to do a player-for-player swap. But Dallas didn't want to, having already lost their center to retirement, did not want to give up another significant offensive lineman and create an issue there. I don't really understand how, if that report is accurate, how it's gone from a straight up trade for Lyle Collins to this kind of an outlay. And again, to me, it feels a lot like the Seahawks have given up what the Jets wanted, because the Jets had all of the negotiating power in these talks, because the Seahawks felt like they had to do something, and this was the best player available for trade.
Well, in terms of precedents, then I suppose the Jalen Ramsey deal might be the closest one, because it is a player in the secondary. They gave up 2 first-round picks, a 4th-round pick. So that may match it. I think another thing to consider, too, the fact that with him being a player in the secondary, you don't have to pay him as much as the Rams would have to pay Ramsey, I think. I think the contract negotiations for a guy like Jamal Adams should be relatively easy. He's the best player at his position, so you pay him the most money.
I mean, I don't know if you saw the report recently, but he's been quoted as saying that he
should get corner money.
I think he was after significant money, you know, almost 20 million plus. I'm trying to find the article now, but he was quoted recently as saying, you know, with the kind of money that he wants. And I think he wanted to be paid to be the most expensive defensive back. So you're looking at Byron Jones, who was signed with Miami. I think his deal is about $18.5 million. So he's going to want serious money. He's going to want to be, you know, in that Bobby Wagner type range for a salary. The thing the Seahawks have got is that he's contracted for a couple of years, and then you've got the franchise tag. A franchise tag for safety is not particularly outrageous, as long as he is willing to play on the franchise tag, of course, and not hold out. Then you've got him for 3 years, and you could even franchise tag him twice, 4 years. But again, that's you would need the player to be willing to actually turn up and work out and train and stuff like that, you know, under those terms. And, you know, we've seen plenty of players refuse to play under the franchise tag. So it'll be up to the Seahawks to decide what they want to do, whether they want to play that game or whether they just want to tie him up. I suspect that at some point, you know, probably, I don't think this season, maybe in the next off season, when they've got a better idea of what the cap's going to be, the full economic impact of coronavirus, then they'll be able to turn to him and make an offer. So I don't think there's anything going to be imminent there. And he has said that he's willing to play this year under his current contract. He just didn't want to play under his current contract in New York. So,
Well, let's talk about that contract for a second, because it's not going to impact the Seahawks salary cap really at all this year. In 2020, he is a $3,500,000 cap hit. And when you consider the fact that Bradley McDougal is now going to the Jets, let's see, McDougal is set to make $4 million under the cap. So they actually make like $400,000 in cap savings with this trade this year.
Yeah, it's pretty much a wash, you know, in terms of the cap situation for this year. Of course, they didn't have a great deal of cap space before this trade anyway. I mean, right. You were talking about $5 million, I think. Because, you know, and a lot of people have been tweeting saying they've got 10 million or they've got 13 million or whatever. No, you know, they haven't signed most of their rookie class yet. I think there's a couple of players who have signed, unless I'm mistaken. There's a couple of guys. That's it.
Yeah, so there's just Parkinson and Swain are the only two under contract right now.
So the rest of those guys are going to cost, and including your first two picks, you know, you've got a first, second and third rounder who are unsigned, who are going to come off, going to take money off the cap. You've got to save money for your practice squad and your injured reserve as well. And you always like to have a little bit of wiggle room, because if you need to sign someone during the season, then you need to be able to do that. So, you know, they don't have a lot of money left. And, you know, this is the thing, you know, I mean, I'm looking at Twitter, and look, I know Twitter's it's the wrong place to go on a night like this, because you get extremes. You know, I could go on, you know, I've already, you know, voiced some concerns or raised some reservations about the trade because of the cost. And the reaction is, you know, what kind of a fan are you if you can't get excited about this? The Seahawks are trying to win a Super Bowl. It's great. But, I think you kind of have to analyze a trade. If you want to just be a fan and say it's great because you like big name players and this is a big name player, then that's fine. No one's going to dismiss that. There's nothing wrong with just being a great Seahawks fan about it and just enjoying the excitement of a huge trade. No one should diminish that. But you also, you know, there are some people who like to analyze it. And, you know, the cost, the other thing to think about is, you know, the outlay, you might as well include Marquise Blair's second round pick in the outlay of this trade. Because how on earth is Marquise Blair making the team now? I mean, Jamal Adams is not a free safety. Quandre Diggs is a free safety. What is Marquise Blair? Is that a write-off? Is that pick a write-off after 1 year?
Well, it does say something that they were willing to trade, or that the Jets accepted in compensation, McDougal versus sending a player like Marquise Blair, because they may have had some interest in Blair and they said, well, we'll just up the draft compensation to keep Blair and send McDougal.
No, I think Blair would have cost the Seahawks money to trade him because he's only a year into his deal. So it would have probably cost him $1 million or $2 million.
Right. This has the cap. So this offsets the cap.
The dead cap hit is not realistic to trade a player after 1 year. So, you know, you save $4 million with McDougal. McDougal's a lot older. You know, that made a lot more sense to trade him rather than Blair. But there just isn't the pathway now for Marquise Blair to get into the starting lineup because of this trade. So then you look back and you think, well, what does it say about Marquise Blair? Because I've no doubt Pete Carroll will come out and say they've got a role for Blair and they'll find a way to get him on the field. But realistically, how likely is that? Because he's not a nickel corner. So sure. How are you going to get him on the field? And then you can look back at the last draft and you go, well, hang on a minute. So if you are sort of saying you've had to trade two first round picks because Marquise Blair, who you took in the second round, isn't the answer. And you took LJ Collier in that draft as well. And who can say with any real confidence that he's going to amount to anything after his rookie season? You know, we all hope that he can do a lot more in year two, but you know, it's hard to be confident about that pick now. So are we now saying that the first two picks are a bit of a wash, you know, that they've not really produced much there. Now they've made this trade. The pass rush still remains a huge issue. I mean, it's okay spending two first round picks on a safety, but if you're relying on Rasheem Green and Benson Mayoa to get your pressure on first down, is it going to make any difference? And that is a question that warrants asking.
Well, you've just made the argument, Rob, against Marquise Blair and against LJ Collier. The Seahawks aren't very good with picking early guys anyway.
Yeah, look, it's a fair point for anybody to raise.
John Schneider may be recognizing that and going, okay, well, I can give up two firsts.
It's a fair point to raise, but the kind of, whenever anybody has said that, and trust me, that is a point that has come up a lot.
Oh, sure.
On the blog over the years, that people have said, why don't they just trade away their high picks because they never do anything with them anyway? And I've always said, well, yeah, but that you just know that 1 year that you've traded away that first round, that future first round pick, will be the year that Russell Wilson gets injured and you end up picking in the top five.
And, right. And then it goes to another team. Well, just like with what the Broncos did when they traded us their first round pick in what was it, 2020, or when it was 2010, and the Seahawks were able to get Earl Thomas right in the middle of the draft. So with that Broncos swap. So
You don't know when you trade blind. You don't know what you're trading away. So that's kind of it's great to say the Seahawks, okay, they never do any good in the end of the first round. You don't know where that pick's going to be. You also don't know, you know, that could be the year that you end up with a really good player. I don't know. Look, there's just a lot of layers to this. My biggest concern with it, on top of the outlay, on top of the fact that it kind of says that Marquise Blair is a bit of a write-off, is that the pass rush still remains unaddressed. That they came into this offseason and everybody knew it, they had to fix the pass rush. And they've replaced Jadeveon Clowney and Quinton Jefferson and Al Woods with a couple of rookie pass rushers, Benson Mayo and Bruce Irvin, and they haven't even replaced Al Woods or Quinton Jefferson yet. So my concern would be, if you are lining up Rasheem Green bookending Benson Mayoa, and if, you know, you're rotating in people like Brian Monet at defensive tackle, then is it going to make much of a difference whether you're paying $25 million to your linebackers and you've got a safety there that costs two first-round picks? Because I would imagine that they're going to be a little bit exposed.
Well, that leads me to another question for you. Is, with considering this big trade package, what other player could they have potentially gone after and been successful in a potential trade? Are there any pass rushers or defensive linemen where you could have put this deal on the table and gotten a significant player on the defensive line.
It's hard to say because we don't know what, you know, what position the Chiefs were in with Chris Jones, whether they would have accepted. I mean, listen, I would have imagined that a trade, this is such a big trade. I mean, this is a, like I say, we talked about the Khalil Mack deal. If you went to Kansas City and said, we'll give you this for Chris Jones, then I suspect that there would have been a little bit of interest there before he re-signed his deal. Obviously, the Chiefs got it done now, so they would, you know, they'd probably rather have Jones than picks, especially given where they are in terms of trying to repeat and win another Super Bowl.
Would you rather have Jones?
I don't know because I they need to fix the pass rush but I just worry a little bit about Chris Jones. I mean, this is a player that slouched his way through his college career, ended up in the early second round for a reason, even though he was a 5-star recruit, and yeah, he's turned it on for the Chiefs. But I just wonder a little bit, like, you know, Albert Haynesworth.
Right
now that he's
yeah,
been paid,
I'm way less excited about interior defensive line guys. So yeah. if I had a choice between Chris Jones and Jamal Adams, I would take Adams in this case. But I am curious if there's some other pass rusher. Like, Yannick Ngakoue is one of those names that came up. I don't know if the Browns would have dealt Myles Garrett, considering they gave him such a big payday as well. But
I think you'd have been looking at like Ngakoue, like you say. I just don't, you know, for me, you could have got Calais Campbell for a 5th round pick, and yeah, he's an older guy, but right. You know, just that would really solidify the interior, and being aggressive there would have meant maybe giving up a 3rd instead of a 5th to make it happen. I don't know, or a 4th.
Yeah, nobody would have been upset about trading a 3rd or a 4th for Calais Campbell.
For a couple of years, Calais Campbell would have been justifiable. Could they have, you know, made some kind of a deal similar to what, you know, Dante Fowler was after or Robert Quinn? Was there a trade out there that maybe didn't cost as much as this, but would have cost maybe a little bit less? Possibly. We'll never know, will we? We'll never know, for example, what Denver might have been willing to accept for Von Miller, for example, or something like that. They may have been open to a 1st and a 3rd for a player who is 30 years old. Yeah, he's, but you know, and the point is none of this is a review of Jamal Adams as a player, or, you know, in terms of his age, his talent, what he's going to bring to the team. It's a very attractive addition for the Seahawks, and we talked about that at the start.
Team captain.
Yeah, exactly. And he's, you know, they need players like that, and it's not, none of this is a review of Jamal Adams as a player. But to me, the crux of this trade is more a review of where the Seahawks are. Is it a panic move the week before the season starts in earnest? To me, it feels a little bit like that, that essentially Jamal Adams is the best player out there, and they felt they needed to do something, and they've done it. And some people will just be happy because they've acquired a great player, and others, such as myself, will say, look, fine, you've traded for Jamal Adams, but is it too expensive? You know, what's the situation with the pass rush? What does it mean for Marquise Blair? What does it mean for the overall direction and strategy of this team? Are they now essentially in a bit of a desperation mode, feeling like they're not particularly close to a Super Bowl? They have had 3 years of a reset now and haven't really got anywhere. You know, they're not better than they were in 2018 currently. You know, so we've got to go and do something. We'll go and get Jamal Adams. Would they have been better off, you know, they're going to end up paying Jamal Adams a huge salary. Would they have been better off keeping Frank Clark a year ago? Would they have been and adding from there? Would they have been better? You could run through all of these different scenarios. And really, at the end of the day, it does warrant that kind of analysis, because none of us want to see the Seahawks go through the next, you know, the rest of this Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson era without winning another Super Bowl or even getting close to that. I mean, none of us want to see the Seahawks just whimper out in the wild card round or the divisional round again. None of us want to see the pass rush or the defense as bad as it was last year. And, you know, I'm a little bit concerned that we are going to witness that. It's just that we'll be witnessing that without any first round picks for the next couple of years.
Well, one thing with this deal is that John Schneider has now told us that he is not done going into this season. He may still not be done, Rob. So could there be a Clowney deal around the corner? Could there be another pass rusher deal around the corner? Could there be an interior defensive player that they add? If they add Clowney and an interior defender in the next 2 weeks, then do you start to look at this defensive line a little bit differently?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. I mean, if they were to bring in Jadeveon Clowney, and then you're saying it's Jadeveon Clowney on one side with, you know, Maiowa and Irvin and Taylor rotating on the other side, that's a completely different prospect. And, you know, if Taylor ever amounts to anything, then, you know, you've potentially got a really good bookend there. So yes, I mean, that changes a lot. And they have to sign a defensive tackle, because it's just a numbers game more than anything else. I mean, they have Jaron Reed and Puna Ford, and then you're getting into DeMarcus Christmas, who didn't play a snap last year because of injury, and Brian Manet.
yes, the interior defense is looking, in terms of depth, not great.
And this is a position that you rotate a lot. I mean, this is, you know, in a game, you don't have your defensive tackles playing every snap. You know, it would only take Reed or Ford or both to get an injury, and then you're in a crisis point. So They need another defensive tackle. I mean, they have to replace the body space that Al Woods has left. So that has to come in. There are some options there. I do think that the ship sailed with Clowney a long time ago, on reflection, because when they started signing, you know, players, you know, when it was revealed what Bruce Irvin's salary was, when it was revealed how much Carlos Hyde's salary was, it started as, hang on a minute, they've just not got the money now. And if they've got about $5 million and they have to sign a defensive tackle, you know, people are saying, well, they could do this, they could do that. Really, their only two options are to cut someone like Brandon Jackson, who will save about $2 million, and then ask Russell Wilson or Tyler Lockett to turn some of their salary into bonus and create some room, essentially putting their salaries on a credit card for the future, which is, you know, it's an option. Teams do it all the time. The Seahawks did it a couple of years ago, I think, with Wilson's contract in order to, and I think Doug Baldwin as well, in order to sign maybe Sheldon Richardson or somebody else. I don't know. They made some salary cap space by doing this. But, you know, this is a player that was turning down apparently 15, 16 million a year, you know, a few weeks ago. Is he now going to say, well, you know, I made a huge mistake, I will take a $6 million contract? You know, it just seems... Yeah. You'd almost think he's more likely to just say, I'm going to sit out the season rather than, you know, it's, having got this far, is he really going to accept any deal now? That's the question I would ask. So yeah. I think they've made the bed with the pass rush. And I think it's now a case of, can they get a defensive tackle at a cheap cost, which enables them to, you know, go and get Josh Gordon or Antonio Brown or somebody, whoever else it is that they're thinking of signing.
Well, if I were KJ Wright, I would be a little bit nervous in terms of where my salary is at going into the season at this point, especially with McDougal having left now. Jaron Reed, though, he's still number 91, so they haven't given up necessarily. You know, we heard when Reed was saying, hey, I'm getting my number 90 back, and it sounded like, hey, maybe not so fast. I guess I'm still not ready to give it up at this point.
Yeah, I think the thing with KJ Wright is, It would be a completely classless move on behalf of the Seahawks to do it now. I mean, they could have cut KJ Wright right at the start of the offseason and saved $7.5 million. And by not doing that, they've cost themselves $1 million for a start. So it wouldn't make financial sense to do it now as opposed to much earlier in the year.
Other ways that you could go about it too. You could sign him to an extension and probably save yourself some cap space that way too.
I think that's probably unlikely given they've just spent a first round pick on a linebacker, but you know, they cut Justin Britton, DJ Fluka, like a couple of days after the draft, if memory serves.
Right.
And if there was a time, you know, the last possible point where they were going to say to KJ Wright, we're going to move on, was 3 days after you draft a first round linebacker and you cut two other guys, including one guy who's been a, you know, club stalwart for a number of years, for 6 years. So I think if KJ Wright was going, it would have happened then. I mean, it would make no sense to do it now. So I think he's pretty safe on his salary, which means they are going to spend $25 million on two linebackers this year. And that's not even including the first round pick. So, you know, that they've put a huge investment in there. You know, they could pick at some of the guys that they've signed, you know, on tenders. It'd be very easy to create about $11 million, but then you'd just be hacking away at your depth. So you'd just say, you could get rid of Jackson, you could get rid of Hollister, you could get rid of David Moore, you could get rid of, you know, a couple of other guys, you know, Joey Hunt, people like that. But then you'd have to replace Hunt, unless you really believe Ethan Posick's a center that you can rely on as a backup. You'd have to replace David Moore. Okay, maybe they could do it with Josh Gordon. But again, you know, they've having tendered all these guys in the first place, it would be a bit unusual now to just sort of remove about four or five players from the roster. I mean, look, I'm saying all this. This is an instant reaction podcast, right, Brandon. And do you know what? As I was speaking, I was thinking, yeah, but they've got to get the roster down to 80. And the cap situation is different because of, you know, it's not a 90-man roster, it's an 80-man roster and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Maybe they'd be more inclined to remove a David Moore and get it down initially and then sign a Josh Gordon maybe for a minimum down the line. I don't know. But either way,
And even it's a guy like Moore, if you did that, I suppose, I mean, it would be shrewd to cut him and then sign him back during the season. But I think that could be done.
Yeah. There are some options to create some extra room. But again, you know, if the Seahawks had $20 million to spend right now, I would say get Clowney inked to a contract today. But they don't. They have about $5 million and they still need to sign a defensive tackle, which, you know, let's say that Snacks Harrison or Brandon Mebane says, I'll play for $3 million, mm-hmm. which is about what you'd expect. That leaves you with $2 million. I mean, you know, how are you going to come together with a package that would entice Jadeveon Clowney to come back? I mean, he was on about 7 or 8 with the Seahawks last year, but then Houston were topping up his deal. I mean, even to get back to what he was on last year would be a huge, you'd have to make a whopping saving. I mean, it would just, I just don't see the plausible route to getting to that kind of money, which is why I think, unfortunately, when people like Brady Henderson were saying months ago, it's very unlikely Clowney's coming back now, that is probably true. And that's the issue that I have, really, is that, you know, the Seahawks are going to go into next year. And how on earth are they going to create pressure? I want to make one quick point, because people have said, well, Jamal Adams, you know, he sacks people. He got a load of sacks last year. He got more than the Seahawks or something, you know, the top sacker last year. A lot of people have made this point, Brad, and I think this is an important point counter to that to make. So Adams had 6.5 sacks for the Jets last year. He was playing for Greg Williams, who infamously described himself as Dr. Blitz a few years ago.
Right.
Which is just a ridiculous nickname to give yourself. I mean, like, if somebody else...
Well, you just don't give yourself nicknames.
If someone called me Dr. Blitz, I go, do you mind not calling me that, please? You know, it's just, it's not, I don't like that nickname. I prefer just to call me Greg. But he actually dubbed himself Dr. Blitz. So Adams blitzed 90 times during the 2019 season, which was the 9th most by any player at any position in the NFL.
Oh, wow.
Baltimore's Chuck Clark, in a similar scheme, was the only safety in the entire league who blitzed at a similar rate. And Baltimore's and Williams' defense, they're very blitz heavy. So that's the kind of scheme that is the complete opposite of what the Seahawks run. In comparison, Bradley McDougald in Seattle blitzed 21 times. So that was 69 yeah. less than Jamal Adams. Even Bobby Wagner only blitzed 71 times last year compared to Adams' 90. So, you know, in Seattle's scheme, they are not going to ask Jamal Adams to go after the quarterback. I'm sorry. You know, Greg Williams operates in a very different way to Pete Carroll. And, you know, Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas, do you know how many they had? Do you know how many sacks they had?
I know Earl had 0.
Yes.
And so Earl Cam
had 0.
I'm going to say Cam had maybe 2.
Cam had 2, correct. So the two of them combined for 2 sacks in their Seahawks career.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, anybody who thinks Jamal Adams is going to come in and suddenly stick 6-7 sacks onto Seattle's list, I'm afraid is probably going to be disappointed.
Well, I think even for a lot of Seahawks fans that look at this realistically, they look back at the past trades, the big trades the Seahawks have made, trading for Clowney. Go look at the Sheldon Richardson deal with the Jets where they gave up a second round pick. You know, there was the Percy Harvin deal where they gave up a first. There was the Jimmy Graham deal where they gave up a first. Traditionally, the Seahawks' big trades have not worked out super great. So I could see where there's maybe some pessimism involved. But there's also a place for us optimists who say this is the one that works out.
I think it's, you know, some of those are the trades. So when they traded for Harvin, I mean, they traded for Harvin just before they signed Bennett and Averill. And, you know, 2013 felt like the year, didn't it? I mean, you think back to that time. Russell Wilson has emerged. You've just had the Atlanta playoff defeat. The Seahawks were a rising force in the NFL. And then the Harvin trade comes in right before the 2013 draft. You knew that the Seahawks had, I think it was pick 25 in that draft. So you knew exactly what you were giving up. I remember, I mean, my wife was pregnant in 2013. And we went to the Lake District for a break in March. And she was, funny enough, watching Game of Thrones before it was like a big thing. And I was kind of like ignoring it in the background. And I was doing a mock draft. And I remember sitting there and I spent like an hour stuck who to give the Seahawks. I was like, I have no idea who to mock. There was just nobody who stands out. And then if like a couple of weeks later, they traded for Percy Harvin. I was like, it made sense because they just, there was no obvious player in that draft that screamed Seahawks. And then they go and trade for Harvin and it made some sense. And then the Jimmy Graham thing, again, they knew they were picking number 31 overall in the draft. They just lost a Super Bowl where if they'd have had Jimmy Graham in on the field in that red zone, then maybe throwing it wouldn't have been such a bad thing after all. Again, you can make a plausible case for that trade given the circumstances. This feels to me a lot more like the Sheldon Richardson, Dwayne Brown trades. So if you remember in 2017, McDowell got injured right before the season. They go and trade for Sheldon Richardson, and the second round pick wasn't anywhere near as expensive as this, but it felt like an overpay because he was a rental.
Yeah.
He was a 1 year guy, and the prospects of signing him beyond that was, it could go either way. So a second round pick felt very expensive. It felt like a desperation move. They had to go and get this guy. They were going to go for a Super Bowl. And then during the season, again, you know, they'd had the issue with George Fant getting injured. Reese Odiyombo was a liability at left tackle. They made a very aggressive move to go and get Dwayne Brown. Again, it felt like they were in desperation mode. And then they subsequently spent the next 2 years trying to recover from being so aggressive. You know, they had no picks. They were constantly having to trade down. They didn't have the cap space to go and do anything because they'd invested all this money in doing certain things, extending players, trading for players. And they spent 2 years resetting because of the aggressive moves that they made in 2016 and 2017. And now they're in a similar situation. We're right before the season. They needed to do something. They've gone and desperately made a big trade. Are they going to end up spending the next 2 years with no picks again? Are they going to have some kind of cap issue down the line? Is there going to be a contract negotiation that gets fractious with Jamal Adams? I don't know. Are they going to end up having to do what they did all over again and having another reset off the back of this? I don't know. And, you know, I think it's only right if you want to be serious about this trade and analyze it is to consider some of these things on top of the fact that Jamal Adams is a great player. I think you go, as a Seahawks fan, you've got to do yourself the justice of sort of considering the bigger picture here, rather than just dismissing people who are raising some of these concerns as negative.
Well, how do you feel, Rob? How do you feel about this idea now of this secondary coming together? Because, you know, when it was McDougal and Quandre Diggs, okay, I guess you had some hope there that Marquise Blair could move into that starting role. And maybe this kind of signals that you may be giving up a certain extent. Maybe you just see him as a nice depth piece at this point, if you're John Schneider and Pete Carroll. But when you look at that starting four now, and let's put Trey Flowers in there for now, but the top three, really, Quandre Diggs, Jamal Adams, and Shaquille Griffin, I feel like that's a really nice three. And with the expectation that maybe Trey Flowers can build off of that disappointing season last season and become a reliable starter.
Well, I really like the duo at safety. I mean, it's a fantastic tandem, you know, with Diggs and Adams. That is a fantastic duo. It's the best pairing of safeties in the league. I mean, it's just, it's incredibly, it's playmaking, toughness, range in the case of Diggs, leadership, maturity, talent. You know, it's a fantastic duo at safety. I think, broadly speaking, you know, what happens with Shaquille Griffin is a question mark. I don't personally feel like a player who has three career interceptions in 3 years, two of which came in one game against Mitchell Trubisky, the other one came in a game where Arizona's like third or fourth string quarterback threw it into he threw it straight to Earl Thomas, right, and Shaquille Griffin, who were both stood next to each other, and they both nearly ran into each other to make the pick. For me, if you're going to pay a cornerback big money, you want a bit more than that. And I think Shaquille's a good player, but I don't think he's a great player. So I don't know. I don't know how you come to an agreement on him before without letting him test the market. So, you know, question mark there. On the other side, who knows what can happen with Quinton Dunbar? That is just crazy, that situation. Trey Flowers has got a lot to prove this year. Whether Dunbar plays or not, he's got a lot to prove. So I think in terms of the overall secondary as a four, you think amazing at safety, some question marks at cornerback, and then the other thing to throw in there is the nickel. What the heck are they going to do at nickel?
Right.
Because they haven't signed one. You know, it felt like inevitable that they would add somebody, or draft somebody who could do that. They've just completely ignored the position.
Yeah.
So that
and
would
you have
suggest,
to wonder, are they that excited about Ugo Amadi?
Well, you can't be. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, look, people want to be optimistic about Amadi as a nickel cornerback. He's a safety. And he was exposed in that position. And look, nickel's probably the hardest position to play on defense. It's really, really difficult to play. So to expect him to transition to that as a rookie and nail it, it would be incredibly unfair. But at the same time, you've also got to be realistic about it. He's not quick. He's not as fast as Coleman was. He doesn't have the kind of the skill set that you would associate with a natural nickel safety. So I don't think that's presumably from this trade, they're probably going to try a lot of three safety sets and do some of that, which is fine. But then what happens when, you know, you have to cover somebody really dynamic in the slot? So we'll see what happens there. So I think, yeah, your safety tandem, amazing. Everything else is a question mark. And I can just add on to this. You said, so how do I feel? Do you know when I saw it flash up, someone who wrote on the blog, this is when I first saw it, they went, Seahawks have traded for Jamal Adams in capitals. And I'd just been on Twitter and not seen anything. So I thought this guy was having his on. I thought he was trolling and having a joke. And then I went on and just typed in Jamal Adams into the search bar. And I saw a New York journalist had tweeted that this was happening. And my first instinct was really excited. You know, I was really, really excited. I thought, great, they've done something. Jamal Adams, like Jamal Adams a lot. Fantastic. And then when I went back onto into your main timeline and I saw the compensation from Adam Schefter, that's when I started thinking, whoa, you know, that is a lot. And then I started to formulate opinions that were not entirely positive about this. And it smacked of a panic move. So it's kind of the real, you know, range of emotions in reacting to this trade.
Looking at Twitter, Chris Clough, at Seahawk Talk on Twitter, he said he did a quick calculation and said, and that's tough to come up with the exact calculation because we don't know what the picks are. But, you know, generally you can look at first round picks a year out and assign a value to them. And he said essentially that what the Seahawks gave up was a 13th overall pick.
Yeah, I saw that tweet and I thought it was a good tweet. And it adds some perspective is a big thing. And I've given you some opinions here, Brandon. I've written a blog post. Wrote a blog post like within 5 minutes of the trade that's not entirely positive. And it's important to acknowledge a tweet like that because it's a very good point. That is essentially what the Seahawks have given up. But then that also assumes that the pick later on, and as I mentioned, you just don't know what the year that,
yeah,
touch wood that this doesn't happen, Russell Wilson gets hurt, and let's say they end up in a position to draft Penny Sewell next year and have your left tackle for the next 15 years. Or, you know, Jamar Chase.
Oh, there's some risk. There is definitely some risk with doing this.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you look at...
But you can also say, too, the risk associated with, say, you have the 13th pick overall. Say you're in the situation of what the 49ers were with trading away DeForest Buckner and then having the pick to where they could get Javon Kinlaw. Well, Kinlaw, he looked like he was, you know, an excellent pass rusher in college. There's a lot of those guys that haven't worked out, though.
Absolutely. And also the other thing is you don't make a trade considering the worst case scenario. You don't, you know, if you're a team trying to contend like the Seahawks, you don't think, well, we won't make this trade in case everything goes horribly wrong.
In case Russell Wilson gets hurt for the next 2 years.
you don't think that way. So right. That, you know, but I'm just saying this is more of a counter to the, well, they've just traded a 13th overall pick, you know, they've traded up essentially to go to move up 10, 20 spots or something like that. To get him. That's true if the Seahawks stay on their current trajectory and, you know, are a playoff team for the next couple of years. But there's so many things. It's not a home run. You know, if it's not DeAndre Hopkins. If the trade there for what was essentially a second rounder and a running back they didn't want anymore, we would have come on a podcast if that was the Seahawks and gone, what on earth are the Texans doing? You know, this is a huge steal for the Seahawks. It just so happens that he went to a division rival instead.
Yeah.
With this, it warrants a lot more weighing up of the pros and the cons. And, you know, you can write a long list of pros because he's a fantastic player and we've talked about some of his positives. Some people will probably say not enough on this podcast, but
I do feel like maybe we haven't hit on that enough. But
we can maybe spend a little bit of time on that before we finish. But, you know, he's a real list of on-the-field positives. But then... I wouldn't even call them negatives. I'd just say reasons to challenge and question the move. Reasons to want to sort of challenge the front office and what has led them to this point. And I think it really does come back to the point I made at the start. If the Seahawks really believed that they needed to have Jamal Adams, then why wasn't this done a lot earlier in the offseason? And isn't it just a case of a team that hasn't done enough this offseason felt like they had to do something? And this is the move. The move for the only player that any of us knew was available.
I mean, I've had a bit of trouble working through it myself. But again, I go back to the caliber of player and what the Seahawks have traditionally done with their first round picks. And to get this caliber of player, where did you have him going when you were leading up to the 2017 draft? Did you have Adams as a top 10 pick at that point as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was a consensus top 10 pick. I'm actually just trying to dig out my final 20. Was it the 2017 draft?
It was 2017. Yeah, that he went sixth overall.
So I've got my final 2017 NFL mock draft. I had Cleveland taking Myles Garrett. I had then had number two, San Francisco, taking Solomon Thomas. Of course, what happened is Chicago traded up one spot, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right.
To get Mitch Trubisky, and then San Francisco took Solomon Thomas at number three. And what I had is I had Jamal Adams at number three to Chicago.
Okay.
So because they'd actually signed Mike Glennon and were saying that he was their quarterback at the time.
I know, again, this
it's kind of strange, this, you know, to think how it all unfolded in the end, but Chicago had spent a lot of money on Glennon, and I had them taking Jamal Adams, which was a need for the Bears at the time, but obviously that didn't happen. So I had him in the top three.
And he hasn't disappointed as being a top 10 pick.
And, you know, when you watched him at LSU, it was, I think, going into, from trying to think back, because I didn't spend too much time on him, you know, in the build-up to the draft, because there was never any chance of the Seahawks drafting him, you know, because he was going to go very, very early.
Right.
My thought going into 2017 was that he was maybe a tad overrated. That he was one of these players that is a big name in college football, and it happens every year. A big name, everyone thinks he's going to go in the top 10, ends up going a lot later, and then everybody's kind of, you know, never brings it back up that, you know, several experts thought he was going to go very, very early and end up going a lot later. When it actually gets around to the draft, but sometimes these players, you can kind of see that they're not quite as good as you thought. But then actually watching in 2017, he did have an impact. You know, when you were watching other LSU players, you would see that he was very much the emotional leader of the team. He was physically, his tackling was very good. He could play up in the box. He was a playmaker. He's very intense. You then see him come and play for the Jets, and it was just, he just fit in like an absolute natural. I mean, straight away he came into the league and was making plays. There was no real period of adjustment for him. You know, I think it's even fair to say he probably settled into the NFL better than Earl Thomas did. I mean, Earl Thomas had quite a rough rookie season, but was kind of thrown in there because the Seahawks were basically an expansion franchise in 2010.
Right.
And it was, you know, someone had to play there. So it might as well be the you know, the number 14 overall pick. So, yeah, I think that he showed straight away that he was a natural, you know, he's an all pro very early in his career.
Yeah, just this last season.
People have talked about him in saying he's a future Hall of Famer already. That he is a, you know, I know it's a term that gets thrown around far too often, but people have said that he's a generational safety, a generational player. Some people have used that term to describe him, who have watched him an awful lot. He's extremely well, you know, when the players in the NFL respect you and give you the kind of attention that he gets, you know it's legit. You don't generally hear players pumped up by other veterans as much as someone like Jamal Adams is, unless they're really, really good and they command that respect. And, you know, the rest of the teams in the NFC West may well sort of have a bit of a chuckle to themselves at the cost, especially, you know, Cardinals fans, given what they've just spent for DeAndre Hopkins, or maybe even the Niners fans, because they basically got Trent Williams for a bag of footballs from Washington. They may well have a little bit of a chuckle, but they'll also be thinking the Seahawks have just got a bit better because they've acquired Jamal Adams. So, and they'll be a little bit nervous now, hoping that the Seahawks don't re-sign Jadeveon Clowney and do any further moves to the defensive line. I mean, for me, I'd really like to see, we've talked about how, whether it's likely or not, I'd love to see another move, Brandon, on the D-line, you know, just something that makes you think, okay, fair enough. You know, like,
well, maybe if it isn't Clowney, maybe if it's Griffin, it's just another guy to add to the pass rush rotation, because At least when you looked at the team last year, you looked at the defense, you said, okay, there's two guys on the defense that every offense has to account for. It's Jadeveon Clowney and it's Bobby Wagner. And now with it just being Bobby, there's some concern there. And now you can say, okay, well, it's Bobby Wagner and Jamal Adams. Those are the two that the offense has to account for.
And the thing about last year is in preseason, it was quite painful to watch Cassius Marsh, Barkevious Mingo, and Jacob Martin be your pass rush. And everyone was kind of hoping that Ziggy Ansah was going to be healthy and there was kind of some optimism there, but you know, that soon disappeared into the
right
into space, that he was going to be any kind of contributor in 2019. So it was desperate. And then when they brought in Clowney, it felt like, well, at least they've got somebody and hopefully they can kind of patch it up with Ansah. And you've got a duo there, Clowney and Ansah. Hopefully that's going to be a solution for the Seahawks. And it obviously never proved to be quite that way because Ansah was so useless. You look at it now and you think, well, you know, you're kind of like you're in the same kind of territory. You know, you've got rookies and hopefully, you know, Taylor can do something, but let's not put too much pressure on him. And, you know, you Mayo and Irvin and Rasheem Green and LJ Collier looks like a horrendous pass rush. I mean, there is a reason why PFF ranked the Seahawks 32nd in the NFL with their D-line this week. And if they could just find a couple of guys or something, you know, a defensive tackle and a Clowney or a Griffin or somebody, just to give themselves a shot there to create some pressure, then, you know, you don't need to be the Niners. You don't need five first round picks on your defensive line to have a functioning defense, but you do need to be able to, in Seattle scheme, rush with four.
Right.
You do need to, you're not going to have a lot. You don't blitz a lot. You need to be able to throw four guys out there and get to the quarterback sometimes. And look, Bennett and Ava were never 20 sack guys. They were 9-10 sack guys that created a lot of pressure and helped bring everything else together. The Seahawks need that. I'm sorry, Benson Mayo and Bruce Irvin, they ain't going to do that. When the Seahawks are bringing everything together, those guys were, well, Mayo was like the red shirt guy for a year before he was cut. And Bruce Irvin was as a Sam linebacker because he wasn't taking any snaps at defensive end. So they've got to find some guys there. And if they could just do that, then you start to say, well, they've got Clowney and then they've got, you know, linebackers. They've spent a lot on the linebackers and you've got a couple of great safeties and the cornerback position has never been a huge priority in Seattle's scheme. You know, they've never really needed those huge big money cornerbacks in there to make it tick. You could say that's a defense that's it. And all Russell Wilson needs is a supporting defense. He doesn't need the Legion of Boom necessarily these days. He just needs a defense that's not a liability. And if the Seahawks can get to a point where they don't have a liability at defense, then they've got a chance to do something, to make some noise. Of course, injuries make a big thing and the O-line and how that shapes out is going to be big and you've got to get Carson healthy and you've got to keep your receiver. You could do a bit more receiver maybe, and you know, that's it. And Wilson has to stay healthy, but they would have a chance. I think the problem is right now is it still looks incomplete to me. Yeah. You've made a big trade, but you're still, your number one offseason issue is still glaring. It's pass rush.
Well, it will be something to watch and see if John Schneider continues to address the issues on defense in these next few weeks leading up to the season. Rob, really want to thank you for coming on. Folks need to check out SeahawksDraftBlog.com to check out your reaction there as well. And I'm sure we'll have the show here posted up on your site as well.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully there'll be some more news to come because you know, it's good. Now that we know there's training camp, now that we know there is a season scheduled and it's coming, it's on the horizon, it'd be really good to go into that season, as weird as it's going to be with no fans, believing that the Seahawks can win a Super Bowl.
We'll be watching. We'll be watching for it, Rob. Thanks again for coming on.
Anytime.
A big thanks to Rob Staten for coming on and doing this bonus reaction show. Adam and I will be on coming up next week, late in the week probably, and we'll have more reaction to the Jamal Adams deal then. We'll get to watch a lot more of the Jamal Adams highlights. I know I've been trying to do that just here in the minutes following the deal, so a lot more to look through, and we'll be back for episode 300. If you want to get in the flock, getintheflock.com leading up to that big episode. We have a big interview as part of episode 300. I'm super excited about it. Be sure and tune in for that. Seahawkerspodcast.com. Thanks once again to Rob Staten, SeahawksDraftBlog.com, coming on the show and breaking down and talking about a lot of the concerns associated with such a big deal like this. We will be back later this week. Talk to you then. Go Hawks.